Good evening. Good evening.
Good evening.
Wow. So what do you want to talk about? What do you want to talk about?
I'm this Canadian journalist. No.
Canadian politics. Well, I'm not going to put you to sleep. Lorenzo and Adit are like part of our family in Canada. I'm here with Leon, who his mom was the journalist and interviewed me. And yes, I'm not going to comment about who did what and what she did to get the interview. But I'm very happy that Leon came into my life at 3 years old, and Cammy came a bit later, and also with us here tonight is Gogo, who is our grandmother in the family, and she's here in Canada, learning to live in snow. So, you are all in one way or the other involved in studying international politics and development studies. And, you know, it's challenging to know what the hell you're going to do after this. And so where is this world going to? What does the future hold? And I'm reminded of a discussion I had with my son the other day, because he's just finishing his CJEP in Brebeuf, because we came back here 2 years ago because he spent his whole life in South Africa. He wanted to understand a bit more of the culture here and also to attend CJEP, which doesn't exist in South Africa. But he's taking a year off to travel the world, and not on holiday, but to understand what the future of this world holds for your generation. And I said to him that, really, I think that the challenges you are going to face are, in fact, greater than any of the challenges we face of our generation. Because if you just begin to understand what's happening in the world, beyond the economic crisis of 2008 and 2009, where just in China alone, 20 million people lost their jobs. In South Africa, a million people lost their jobs. Unemployment in the United States is sitting at 10%, but many parts of the United States, you have unemployment shooting up to 20%. My son was in Spain recently, and I said, well, go and understand on a student exchange program, but unemployment amongst young people who are educated like you is probably sitting at 30% and aiming upward. So if one begins to understand the crises that you will face as a generation, it's not just the job crisis, an environmental crisis, an economic crisis, a financial crisis, a food crisis. All our anticipations on food is that by 2050, we'll be 9 billion people on the world. I chair a global foundation that is called GAIN, the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, launched by Kofi Annan, when he was Secretary General of the UN, and Bill Gates, to deal with malnutrition, which faces 2 billion people in the world. But if you really look at it, there's a billion people who are chronically food insecure today. That means they will go to bed tonight and not have a plate of food. There's a billion people who may have food, but it's not the right kind of food. So they are deficient, micronutrient deficient. And there's a billion people who eat too much of food and they are obese. That's nearly half of humanity. Can you imagine that? That's in 2011, in 2050, when you have 9 billion people, what will you have? We know that today, 50% of food that we produce is wasted. We know that 70% of fresh water in the world that we use is used to grow crops. Of that, 40% is wasted. We know that we're running out of arable land, that even if we improve our technologies, we still will not get the productivity in agriculture to meet the needs of people. So what can we conclude is that the system is broken. I was in Bangladesh 10 days ago. And we are launching a big project with BRAC. Does anyone know what BRAC stands for? It's a Bangladesh relief organization. It started off many years ago, similar to the Grameen Bank. Based on microfinance, but launched in a way that builds on a model of development of self-reliance. It's not charity. It's about empowerment of people. Now, BRAC has about 8 million people that receive its loans. They lend about $100 million a month of little amounts of money to people who live in villages so that they can build some sort of life. But most people in Bangladesh will earn less than $1 a day. Now you're sitting there with a bottle of Coke. How much does the Coke cost today? $2.50. $1. Well, now imagine I go to this village and we're producing, doing a product, a project with BRAC. Because 80% of the women in Bangladesh are micronutrient deficient. That means they don't have enough iron or folic acid. That means when they give birth to babies, the babies are underweight. Or the babies will become stunted. Now, one of the challenges that you face in a place like Bangladesh, which is typical to many other countries, is that girls get married when they're about 10, 11, or 12. So you have a micronutrient deficient child who gets married, has a child that is also deficient. And you have an intergenerational cycle. So that's why whenever I talk, I say that the key to true empowerment is the liberation of women. So if you want to do development anywhere in the world, you have to look at the rights of women. To not address the rights of women, well, you're tinkering with something around the system. You're not changing the system. And so it's very important, this, when you're thinking of development. So they have 80,000 volunteers, people that work for them but earn money by taking products, health information, working with village women. Now, they said to me the other day, well, in the last 18 months, the price of rice doubled. Price of rice. So it ended up with it be costing $1 a kilogram. Now, when your average income is $1 a day, do you think you're going to eat fillet? Right? Are you going to eat chicken? Cheap chicken? Hey, you need rice. You need rice 3 times a day. Now, you can't even afford to eat that rice. So you know what happens in some places? They eat grass. You know what mothers will do? They'll stir the pot as if there's something cooking in there, because the children are hungry. But they'll go to bed hungry. The system is broken. So some commodity trader in Chicago, one of these big multinationals, is manipulating prices on the Chicago Stock Exchange. Some of you are studying business here. Oh yes, it creates wonderful bonuses for those traders. But just a change in the price of rice or a staple food throws tens of millions of people into hunger, absolute hunger. So how do we fix that? We've got to address the system. The systemic challenges of the world today that you will face and that you will not be sheltered from. You know, it's like a wonderful country, Canada. I really love it. You all obey the rules here. I keep saying, you know what, in Africa, we sort of drive around traffic signs as a bit of a dive. In Bangladesh, there's no guy given. You just try. You compete for the road with the rickshaws and the cows and animals and people. You know, India is a challenging place. 1 in 7 people is an Indian. There's no space, you know. So I suppose the issue is really about what you study. And it goes back to a model. You know, I was in university. You know, and before I got into university, I was 4 years old when they came and evicted us from our house. And they said, you're the wrong color for this area. That was apartheid. So they moved us out of a house which I grew up in, into another area. They said, this is the area you live in, and you go to a school where there's only Indians, and you live in an area where there's only Indians. I said, well, I'm not an Indian. I may look like an Indian, but I'm not an Indian. Because my great-great-great-grandmother came from India. But I'm South African. You know, if I go to India, I'm a complete foreigner. I may look like the majority of people there, but they know immediately that I'm a foreigner. And so apartheid was about division of people on the basis of race, institutionalized racism that made it a crime against humanity. But our struggle against apartheid was an interesting struggle because a number of the most powerful countries in the West saw the South African apartheid regime as a bulwark against communism. They were terrified of communism, and they saw that a white regime committed to upholding what they believed was Western ideals was their best defense against communism. And so we grew up where everything we fought for was defined as communist. Well, you know, we never lived under communism, so communism seemed a very good idea to us compared to apartheid. So that was the way we grew up. And when I was still in high school, you know, we made a choice. And the choice was very simple. It's a choice of whether you accept justice or stand for justice, or whether you're going to be subservient to injustice. And so the levels of apartheid differed on the basis of color. So someone like me or Gogo, we couldn't go on certain buses, we couldn't live in certain area, we couldn't get certain jobs, we had to go to certain schools, we had to, well, we were second class citizens. And so, but that was petty apartheid. The core of apartheid was that the system, economic system, required huge amounts of labor, of cheap labor, to go and extract the gold and diamonds in the mines. And so what was the form of apartheid was racial discrimination. What the real content of apartheid was a cheap labor system, perpetuating a cheap labor system. And so a lot of it gets disguised, but in effect, that's what it is. They needed cheap labor. And if you deny people human rights, well, you can treat them like commodities. It's not very different than what happens in some parts of the world today. This that they don't call it racism, but the same divisions exist. So when we were young, we had this very brave and powerful leader. He was called Steve Biko. When I was your age in university, going into university, Steve Biko was a leader of what we call the Black Consciousness Movement. This was an assertion that we made that we were human beings and we were proud to be black and that no one was going to take our dignity away from us. So it was an assertion of our humanity, that we were proud to be black. And that is what, in a sense, built our generation of activists that eventually led to a big explosion by students in 1976 against the imposition of Afrikaans, which was the language of the oppressor. And what our view was that we will not accept the language of the oppressor, or the language of the oppressor and the mouths of the oppressed was something that really struck at our soul, and we rejected it. And in that period, we had the explosion of activism. It came on the back of many student resistance movements and an explosion of student activism across, starting off, in fact, the Sorbonne in Paris in 1968. And so the 1970s and the 1980s was an explosion of activism in South Africa. And many of us decided, especially when Steve Biko was murdered, that we will choose a life of what we call permanent revolution. We dropped everything else we had and decided that we had to bring down the apartheid government. And that's why in the 80s, a lot of us left university and went into communities, went into schools, went into trade unions, and built organizations of people to the point where we could force the apartheid regime into a stalemate. Obviously, we were helped, and many of the colleagues that I had didn't survive to see the day because they were either assassinated or killed. But we built a great solidarity movement globally. In fact, one of the most impressive global solidarity actions since the anti-colonial struggles was the anti-apartheid struggle. And many of your parents would have participated in some way or the other in actions. I mean, if I look at Lucy, who I'm married to, she was telling me one day, you know, we had to boycott Bata shoes in Canada. I said, yeah. He says, yeah, our parents said you will not wear Bata shoes because they have a factory in South Africa. So it took me a couple of years, but I said to her one day, you know what? The only shoes I wore when I was young was Bata shoes. Because this was the toughest shoes that there was. We had one pair of shoes a year, and that was Bata shoes, because it was called the Bata Toughies. So, but it was that solidarity that saved the lives of many of us. And so when I went into the trade union movement, it was still illegal. But by the end of the 80s, it was the main pillar of struggle against apartheid, in alliance with the ANC, not a part of the ANC. We were an independent trade union movement. We had independent political aspirations. But as a trade union, we realized we weren't a political party. Therefore, we needed to have an alliance with an organization we could trust. And so the question was, how do you determine an organization that you could trust? And so the principle was, what is its leadership? What is its principles? And what is its program? And so the closest organization to us, from a principle point of view, was African National Congress. It believed in non-racialism. It had an alliance with the South African Communist Party. It was pro-poor. It had a leadership that was tried and tested, like Nelson Mandela and many others. And it had a program around which will be about the fundamental transformation of South Africa. And so we supported them. But the struggle in South Africa wasn't won by the ANC. Was won by the people on the ground. We were all ANC activists. But like in all struggles, where we have a transformation, we always make the assumption that everyone is on the same side. You know, it's like if you ask yourself the question today in Egypt or Tunisia, the fall of those dictatorships was brought about by young people like you who were frustrated with a system in which they saw a plundering elite loot the country. And what they faced was a future with no hope. an explosion of youth unemployment. And in fact, the spark was a young man who was a graduate who was stopped from selling his wares on the side of a street. And that explosion was a spark. So in every transformation, you're going to have the clash of not just ideas, but powerful elites. And so part of the struggle for a better world never stops. And that's why today, many of us that were active in the South African struggle are also active in the global struggle. Because there's an interconnectedness between the struggles that various people are fighting, whether it's in the streets of Cairo, or in the townships of Soweto, or in the villages of Bangladesh. It's about the systemic challenges that we face as the world. And the question you really have to ask yourself, are you going to fit in, or are you going to try and change them? And I was saying, in fact, earlier to Lorenzo and Giselle and Edith, the design of our education has been about how you will have security, how you will have jobs, how you will have income. But in a sense, it's a false future, as North Africa is showing, you know? You know, they say in 2001, the Arab world defined the decade, the past decade. And it was the specter of and threat of fundamentalism, Islamic fundamentalism. That became, because with the collapse of Soviet communism, we needed a new scapegoat. And that was a scapegoat. But in fact, the next decade is also going to be defined, but this time defined by the Arab youth. It's a decade about transparency and about democracy, and about the future that young people want. And that's why I am excited. I am optimistic that the actions of young people topple very powerful dictators. But the battle is not won. Far from being won. You know, the big danger that we keep seeing is that one set of elites get replaced by another set of elites that plunder our countries as much as the previous one. In fact, there's a brilliant book that you should read of the story of John Jitetongo. He led the anti-corruption agency in Kenya, and it's called My Time to Eat. And this is what the elites do in the world. You know, they will rise up against an existing elite, but merely because they want to feed themselves at the trough. And so if you're wanting to change the world, then you've got to think about what world you want. And I suppose that's the question I should leave you with tonight, because I'm very eager to hear the answer to that. Because in a sense, I'm an old guy now. My ideas are old. They represent an old fight. It was a good fight, but it's an old fight. I think the issue about you is, what do you stand for? What are the values you want to see in the world? What's the accountability you want to see from leaders? My wife was talking at a conference the other day. She talked about the phenomenon of brown envelopes. Because all over the world, we see politicians accepting brown envelopes, being bribed, being subservient to economic interests that show no regard for human rights or for the environment or for the world that we live in. That is just consumed by the worship of mammon and pursuit of almost an obscene and conspicuous consumption model. And we all know that that model can't last. That somehow the chassis of this global village of us has to change. And the question is, what will it change for? What will it change to? And so, let me leave you with that grand question. Thank you very much. Now, Lorenzo was warning me that there's so many clever people in this university, and you have a million zillion questions to which I have no answers. So, do you want to start off?
First of all, thank you very much, Mr. Naidu, for your words. I think it'll be resounding in our heads for a while. What I wanted to ask you, I've been dying to ask you, I read an article in The Economist a couple of weeks ago that was comparing South African apartheid to the present situation in Israel and Palestine. Do you perhaps have some thoughts on that?
Good. So we take a set of three questions. Come on. You want to change the world? So let's have some gender representativity here. Yes, sir. Yes, yes. No, we don't have a patent on the word apartheid, actually. It's available to all. You know, let me start off with the question of ideology. You know, I went to the Soviet Union in 1989 to go and meet my comrades in the union movement. And as I traveled around the Soviet Union, I realized one thing. That shit, if I was a trade unionist in the Soviet Union, I would have been in Siberia soap picking. Because, you know, in the end of the day, the idea of egalitarianism is a wonderful idea. You know, it's logical. Every life has equal value. Doesn't that make sense to you? You don't agree? Do you agree every life has equal value?
Yes.
Does it make sense to you? Doesn't matter what your race or your color or your religion or your sex or your sexual orientation. It should be a principle of our humanity. So it's a wonderful idea. But you know, there's one thing that we have to deal with in life. It's human greed. That's the variable. Human greed can take a wonderful idea and corrupt it. And so what we saw in the Soviet Union was a corruption of a wonderful idea. And what the Soviet Union represented at the end of the day was no worse than and no better than what it's claimed to be the opposite of in the West. And, you know, one of the things that what we would define ourselves, many of us, was as independent socialists. That we believed in human rights, we believed in human dignity, and we really believed in the idea of social solidarity. And so for us, what represented the ideal, you know, something that all of you admire, is what and Nelson Mandela will stand for. That there's a humanity that binds us together and that should compel us to share our humanity with, irrespective of which part of the world that humanity is. But anyone who is discriminated against should believe that there are people in the world that stand with them. And so the model that, you know, we had was pragmatic, that recognized as a fact that the market was a reality, that state ownership could not equate to the ultimate democracy. In fact, the more I reflect on it, the more I believe that the state largely is incapable of the type of accountability and innovation we need. So if one takes South Africa, there are certain sectors of our economy that should be state controlled. Access to basic services, whether that's water, that's electricity, that's basic road infrastructure, sanitation. And it should intervene in the economy in a very powerful way to drive an industrial policy. You know, I mean, the Asian tigers were successful because we had a powerful sort of benevolent type dictatorship that will throw employers into prison if they didn't do what the state wanted in the industrial policy. So, you know, you need a state that is interventionist, but you need a mixed economy. And the one thing about the market and the private sector is that there's an innovation in it that's incredibly entrepreneurial, that is always seeking solutions. And so part of the thing that I do today is looking at how one can harness the market to produce products for those at the bottom of the pyramid. How do we incentivize, or using regulation through governments or through the international agencies, get the type of collaborative partnerships between the state, the multilateral sector, and the private sector to increase the range of products that poor people today have? Let me give you an example. So if you really look at the statistics on number of babies dying, of causes where we have the science and the technology to solve, micronutrient deficiency, undernutrition, one child every 10 seconds dies, 3.5 million children a year, of causes that we could prevent almost like that. So one of the reasons is that they don't have the appropriate number of micronutrients for that period from 6 months to 24 months, which is a window of opportunity. You miss nutrition in minus 9 months, the first 1,000 days, from minus 9 months to 2 years. It's the first 1,000 days. You miss that period, and even if you win the lotto, you've lost that potential. And 3.5 million children a year die because they don't receive that. And so part of it is because the poor, the current economic system doesn't believe the poor are a market. So when they're looking for a market, they look at all the sort of middle class people, all your parents, and all your friends, but not the poor. So the idea is that how do we do that? For in Bangladesh, what we launched was a micronutrient sachet, 15 micronutrients in it. And the cost of it for 2 months' supply is $1. It works out to 2.5 tapas, 0.02 cents per day. And it's done with a private sector company and with BRAC, which is the world's largest feeder. So we've got to find the models that are pragmatic, that solve the challenges of development. And that requires us to use the state, it requires us to use the private sector, it requires us to use social businesses like BRAC and Grameen Banker, it requires us to use NGOs, it requires a community that is mobilized, it requires women that are conscious of their rights, and so it requires a type of market that we can harness to deliver to the poor. And I think that the model of capitalism, as we've seen in the world, it's dying. You know, I mean, we're going to elastoplast it for a little while longer, but it's unsustainable. Read the latest Economist and the Financial Times. I'm not talking to you about some radical science here. It's a failed model. Unless something changes dramatically, it's a dead model. And then it's not that suddenly saying, well, what we need is bring back socialism. We've got to find answers to our challenges. And the one thing that I learned as an organizer, you know, when I was a student, you know, students love politics, eh? Theory. So I'll go outside the factory gate and I'll stand there and say, you should support, there's a dictatorship of the proletariat that we need. And you see this capitalist, they're exploiting us. The guy looked, the workers used to look at me like I was bloody lunatic, and I was a lunatic. What the hell is he talking about? Socialism. didn't make any sense to them. So you have to sometimes leave your theory behind and become part of the people you want to serve. Otherwise, your ideas are meaningless. Because the struggle of the poor is day by day they have to put food on the table. So sometimes leave your rocket science behind, use your common sense. So I think it's a very important question then. You know, that ideology at the end of the day, I go to the young woman that I met in that village. She was married at 12 years old. 14, she had her first child. I'm going to expect her theory. What the hell? She's a child. Damn it, she's a child, man. A child with has a mother. What do I explain to her? Battles day to day to feed a child. So you've got to get more realistic about what we want. Apartheid, you know, it's not something that belongs exclusively to us. Apartheid was about an institutionalized racism by law. And but division exists around the world. Genocides exist, you know? Holocaust exists. No one owns that. I mean, so at the end of the day, yes, you can disguise it appropriately. But, you know, if one's come back to the Middle East, you know, it's interesting. But obviously, as a South Africans, our identification was with the Palestinians. You know, that's the natural bonds of solidarity that united us, you know. But the reality is that the failure of a peace process there compared to the success of our political transition. What's the differentiator? One is that we had very powerful organizations on the ground that were independent civil society organizations, independent trade unions, women's organizations, grassroots organizations, civic organizations. It wasn't a bunch of people sitting in exile. We had strong rooted organizations that were democratically run. They had an eternal democracy. So even if Mandela walked into this room, we didn't all stand up and say, well, praise the leader, tell us what to do. We would have fierce debates. We always had fierce debates. When I joined the trade union movement in a room like this, there was a fierce debate for the whole night. People thought I was selling out. Said, because in classical Marxism, trade unions are reformers. You are diluting the revolutionary fervor of the working class. Yeah, sure. Okay. So not people do it. So one of the things that I see in the Middle East in that particular issue around the Palestinian and the Israeli issues is that there's an absence of really strong grassroots organizations that force an accountability. And there's a failure of leadership. Because in a transition that is difficult, remember, we had to make a transition where for 300 years we were excluded and marginalized and whooped by a brutal state. So, you know, when we're on strike, you know, we have big strikes. You know, we bring millions of people out on strike. It's very easy to call people out on strike. You know what's the most difficult thing about a strike? You know what's the most difficult thing? It's telling people to go back. When you haven't won anything. Mine workers strike. 360,000 workers on strike. 21 days later, 10,000 workers a day were getting dispersed. 30,000 workers are dismissed out in buses, shipped into the neighboring states. Shit. They are going to destroy us. What do?
We take a decision to call off the strike. We don't have the time to have all the democratic discussion, but we've got to go and face people in the stadiums. There's 50,000 workers. You can tell those 50,000 workers, well, 10,000 of you lost your jobs, the other 40,000 go back. You get lynched. That's what's always a danger.
So it's about tough decisions that you've got to make. Who are the people that are going to make tough decisions there? Because they're too worried about their own vested interests. In South Africa, we had people on both sides that rose above the conflict and said, the alternative is a scorched earth.
Do we want that for the next generation?
That's what we don't have.
And that's why the positive thing is that the youth of Israel,
united with the youth of Cairo,
you would have something that could be the beginnings of change. Because at the moment, for elites, it doesn't benefit them to have peace.
Why will people want to stop wars?
You know, a lot of the wars today, some of you are doing business here, a lot of the armies of the world today are subcontracted to private armies. Why would they want to stop wars?
Have you ever seen a businessman say, I want to cut my legs at the knees? It's a revenue model.
So, I mean, at the end of the day, they only change, politics only changes when there's a threat to people's position. They're going to lose power.
They're going to be exposed.
They're going to face a trial. They're
going to force the system to put them on trial, like the Minister of Communications in India when I was there last week. Communications Minister is now on trial. He's going to go to jail in India.
That's what he's scared of.
You know, when I was in Bangladesh now, there was a fascinating story I must tell you.
So again, for your business guys.
So I was in Bangladesh. So I'm going to go and meet Professor Mohammed Yunus from Grameen Bank. And he's just been fired by the government. Because, you know, one thing that politicians are absolutely terrified is people who need nothing from them are not afraid of them. They can't handle them. But he doesn't need a position. He's got power. I have no position.
I have more power than if I was in government.
So there's a big altercation in the streets. Police are firing tear gas all the way. Sort of people are throwing stones. So I asked the driver, what's happening here?
He says, no,
they're stoning the stock exchange. I said, what is stoning the stock exchange? Who's stoning the stock exchange?
They said, no, the people that have invested their money are stoning the stock exchange.
So what's happening? He says, because the stock exchange lost 40% of its value, people want their money back.
So before you put your money in the stock exchange,
you better think carefully. Okay, any other questions?
And you. And then we're going to hit that row. And then that row. And then, wow, you're going to get... Okay, yeah.
I was wondering, in the wake of seeing all your friends, your colleagues being murdered or assassinated, what caused you to persevere?
I wanted to ask you about the current crisis in the Middle East and how... the role of trade unions in those revolutions, and do you feel that trade unions are becoming more obsolete in that they're no longer the same? They're no longer the main organizing principle of people.
Okay.
Injustice, and we cannot accept that. And we actually rather die than accept it. So, I mean, you know, it's interesting because at some point they were placing bombs in our cars, and some of our cars that belonged to people that I was working with were bombed. And for like a week, I was like, okay, my car is parked in the street, so I'll go and I'll check under the car, open the boot. And so, you know, after a week, I said, you know, this is crazy. I can't do this. So he's sitting in the car, he goes down, he said, okay. Okay, I haven't checked, but if it goes off, it goes off. Too bad. So he learned to conquer fear. And then you learn to, you know, I mean, a number of us went deadless. I was on the dead list of one of the, in, you know, beyond the government, the former government, there was the, what was called the Heart of Freedom movement. It was a tribal movement. And the leader of that actually ended up in cabinet. And sat next to me. And so did a lot of the people that were part of the whole apartheid system. And you get over it. And this is the whole thing. At some point, you say, listen, past is the past. We will not forget about it. But we've got to look to the future. And you learn. And this is the whole power of our reconciliation, which was the right thing to do. Even when we won the election, there was a threat of a civil war in our country. And it took extraordinary efforts on the side of people like Mandela and us to stop that civil war. Because they wouldn't have won, but they had the most powerful army in the African continent. And there were 500,000 people, whites, who were trained, had arms, and could cause an absolutely devastation in our country. So the question is now, do you want revenge? And we decided not to. We had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where, chaired by Archbishop Tutu, where people had to come into the public eye and confess, admit their crimes. And so a lot of people felt at least there's been an admission of guilt. A lot of people are dissatisfied with it. But, you know, for me, actually he embraces me today and says, you know, I miss you in cabinet, miss you in the parliament. And you know what? He's moved on. We were fighting a war, and the war is over. So, you know, it's, on the trade union side, I mean, it's a very interesting question about, say, Egypt. You know, the trade unions follow the young, the youth. They didn't lead. So one of the challenges of unions is institutionalization. And part of institutionalization is you become, you know, you might be a principal, but you're still part of the system. It's a type of corporatism. You know, COSATU in South Africa has a very interesting relationship with the ANC, because it's an alliance with the ANC. And because we don't really have an opposition in the parliament, we're such a dominant party. The real opposition is civil society. It's often COSATU, that the union movement, that stands up in South Africa and disagrees with government or takes government on critical issues. Right now, a huge battle on the issues of corruption, the issue of women's rights. So there's some big battles that are coming up. The issue of poverty and unemployment and rising inequality in South Africa. So part of our challenge there in South Africa today is about rising inequality. We've had phenomenal deracialization of politics, but we've had huge inequality that has risen. And the rise of also a black oligarchy, which is very similar to the type of ruling elites that you had in North Africa or the rest of Africa or in Asia. So there are some big battles coming. And I think there will be revolve around issues that are fairly principled issues about a return to the values that we fought for. So if you ask me, yes, I'm still part of the ANC, but you know, there's very independent thinkers in there. And there are very powerful groups in there. And if there's a contestation of ideas. That's what politics is about. Politics is always about a contestation. And which grouping is dominant. And, you know, the fierce contestation in developing countries and politics is because politics gives you access to the state.
So if I become the leader of my branch in my area, then I'm going to be the councilor or the mayor in that town. And that gives me access to material wealth. So the contestation in politics is, it's brewing. And it'll be very interesting what happens going into the future. Okay, it's getting really late. So we said we're going to give that group a chance. 1, 2, 3. You've had your chance. Okay, go ahead. One thing is that, you know, you can always learn from other people's experiences, but there's no moral. And I don't think look for a moral. It's really a very subjective thing. You know, what got us to stand up in the late 60s and decide that we had enough is different from what young people in Cairo decided they had enough, or Tunisia decided they had enough. You know, so there's no model of it, really. I mean, beyond the fact that the sense of solidarity we had, and a deep sense of our own humanity, and that it was offensive to have racism, just as much as it's offensive to for me today to see people dying of starvation when we have more than enough food in the world to feed them. And I suppose the model of the 90s, especially after the collapse of the Berlin Wall, was that collectivism and social solidarity were swear words, in fact. You know what they really celebrated? Milton Friedman. Greed is good. And that if you fail, it's your own fault. That was the ideology of the 90s. We shouldn't care about other people. That's why, the growth of MBA schools, it's good. Achievement, individual achievement, become brilliant, become a banker, earn fantastic bonuses, drive a Porsche. That was the model we celebrated. You don't care a damn about those that are starving. That's the model. And really, you can ask yourself today, your generation has to ask yourself today, well, you can live in a little bubble here in Montreal, but you know, one day that bubble will burst as well. So I think that is why I go back to my initial point. I think the challenges you all face are many times bigger than what we face. The world was quite a simple place. But the world is connecting today. And it doesn't need the establishment media. It doesn't need embedded journalists. You communicate amongst yourselves directly. In fact, even TV is becoming direct TV, not mediated by some editorial team sitting in the back room. That's the power of technology. And the issue is, if you go to the developed world, go to Spain, and go to Ireland, and go to United States. There's a lot more talk about the systemic failure, more so than ever before. And so, yeah, that's my general advice, is that really you have to examine your own, you know, you're all very different people here. Yeah. I mean, North America is very interesting because, you know, who's the right to be here? Maybe the American Indians are about the only people that have absolute rights to it. All of you are immigrants, descendants of immigrants. I think it's the article you were talking about was what?
It was called Democracy is Not a Right.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Which is bullshit. Yeah. That's all you deserve as a comment. And your question? I hear you all. Your question? Oh, yes, what happens to it? Now, you know, Mandela is really revered as the father of South Africa's democracy. But that's it. Mandela stepped out of effective government 12 years ago, even before he stepped out. Sure, there would be an absolute loss the world would feel if he has to go. And we should examine why that is. You know, recently he was in hospital because he had some respiratory problems. And the whole world almost came to a standstill. Ask yourself the question, why? And it's got nothing to do with the fact that he was the president of South Africa or is some famous scientist or is a brilliant speaker or Nobel Prize winner. It's about his humanity. His sense of being, his centeredness, that he is able to transform people around him to be better people. And when you're with him, you want to be a better person. That's what makes him a remarkable person. He's not perfect. In fact, he keeps saying, I'm no saint. And this is a terrible thing. Yes, it's a terrible thing. Talk to you about it now, spoil the whole image of him. But he's a human being, Christ. You know, it's like, don't deify people, man. That's our beginning of our problem of politics. We want to put people on a pedestal and suddenly we're scared of them. Or we worship them. It's bullshit, that, man. That's a bullshit form of politics. You know? It's about accountability politics. No one has the solutions to everything. That's what we learn. But even I disagreed with Mandela something. The wonderful thing about him to say, yes, it sounds, you know, I had very different ideas to when you first started this debate. But now you've convinced me. Now that's the sign of a true leader. So, yes, it will be a great shock to us. It will be a shock to humanity. But it should strengthen our resolve that the world we should be building is a world that represents his value. Okay, last one, two, and then okay, you're gonna get it. You missed out.
My question is regarding the land issue in South Africa. I'm from Zimbabwe.
Yes, on the first question, you know, the issue of factors that cause people to move, whether they're black or white, is very interesting, and it's almost universal. You know, if you look at the diaspora, African diaspora, you know, our brightest talent sitting outside the continent, not just South African, and not just whites. So increasingly also black South Africans who are, you know, educated, upwardly mobile, can get jobs anywhere in the world. So there are factors that cause people to leave. Okay, they'll cause white people to leave more than black people, but it's not an issue of race, it's an issue of stability. One of the big challenges of middle classes, and we need middle classes. You know, the amazing thing about Canada is that you have a huge middle class in this country. You know, the one thing that really surprised me when I came to Canada, to Montreal for the first time, I really saw a BMW, a Mercedes-Benz on the road here. Jesus, man, every second car I saw in Joburg is a Mercedes-Benz or a BMW or a SUV, you know? The inequality is so huge. So part of our aspiration is to grow middle class. It's absolutely necessary for the stability of a society. Because you have the skills, you have the capacity, you can build strong public institutions, you can make government work. The one thing that, you know, okay, I followed the law here, even when there's no traffic, my wife says there's no green guy on the other side, don't cross the road. I say, well, my name is Jay, I walk across the road, I do jaywalk. You know, so I think it's like, you follow the rules here. It makes it so predictable, this country. You know, we have a challenge where to park our car so much. So there's a lot of adrenaline in our society. So, you know, the thing is, yes, we have a challenge of that. We have a challenge of crime. But the roots of crime is really going back to this issue of what was the economic deal in South Africa. And, you know, I wrote a book, you know, I can write. I did learn to write when I was in that. A few years I spent in university. part of it, we did a fantastic deracialization of politics. But we did an economic deal. And it was a deal between the established elites of big white conglomerates who decided that they would transfer a certain amount of wealth, BEE, to certain politically connected black individuals. And so one of the challenges that we did not address is the structural challenges of our economy, that there was a persistent and high unemployment that required a different industrial strategy, that required a new approach to education to make it work, that required us to fundamentally change the way we did certain things in the economy, and made certain tough decisions, whether the tough decisions were for trade unionists or they were for people that own the means of production or whether it was for us as government. So we left with a huge challenge of unemployment, the same factor that gave rise to North Africa. Those issues exist within our society, that on average 50% of African youth coming out of schools, 50% have no skills, no job, and are unlikely to have a job in this lifetime if we don't change how we create jobs and what the focus of the society should be. And that breeds anger, people don't have hope, and feeds into crime. Poverty feeds into crime. Because they can see, you know, it's not, you know, they can see the wealth inequality. So we've got to address poverty and inequality. And part of that is retaining those skills, acting against corruption, bringing us back to the path of where we started our
our walk to democracy. And that's, you know, that's part of the big debates in the country today, huge debates, fierce debates. Then on Africa, you know, part of our challenge in Africa is, yes, there is a land grab taking place. It's for, you know, a third of the world's strategic resources sits in Africa. Look at it. Gold, diamonds, aluminium, rare earth metals, iron ore, platinum. I mean, you think about what fuels the global economy is African resources. What is going to address the issue of the food crisis is African arable land. Why do you think that these countries are coming in around the world, buying off tracts of arable land in Africa? So, again, part of our challenge in Africa is a plundering elite. There's no different from that that was toppled in Egypt or is going to be toppled in Libya or was toppled in Philistia. You know? And, you know, the Indian Prime Minister talks of consumption, conspicuous consumption. It's obscene what's happening with the nouveau rich in India. But there's an anger growing in the world about this, and a frustration. So I think that, you know, it comes back to, again, the point of what is your generation going to do? I mean, we face certain challenges in our life. We stood up and we did what we could. I mean, you can sit in this lecture theaters in this wonderful building and have nice debates, so you can go out and fight for that better world that you want. You know? That's your choice. And so, back to the issue of land. The difference between Zimbabwe and South Africa, we had our people forced off the land into wage labor. So, if you really look at South Africa's history, forced labor, in fact, destroyed the peasantry. We don't have peasantry of any substance in South Africa. So if you have to ask poor people in South Africa, what is the top demand you have? It'll be jobs, number one, houses, education, health. Maybe land will come in after that. If you ask someone, do you want a piece of land? Ask me. Oh, shit. Of course I want a piece of land. So it depends how you ask the question. But land is important. But, you know, it's not, we're not like the rest of Africa.
Can I ask about the farm murders that are taking place and have been over the last few years? What is that the evidence of?
Criminal violence.
Yeah.
Pure criminal violence. And again, anger about the fact that people have something and others have nothing. And this is the thing of social exclusion. It's a very powerful force in society. And you will find evidence of it in every society, including here. You know, when people feel that I have no stake in the system, why the hell should I care? What happens to those that have something is when they lose hope. Last questions. Anything? No? It's a very important question because South Africa is very different. That's why I said the model is changes country by country. Can't be the same model. I think the important thing is coming back to something I said earlier. It's around women's empowerment. Because if you look at Africa, 80% of the food in Africa is produced by women. Women are the ones that fall pregnant until we do something different with cloning. That's going to be a reality in the future. They're the ones that breastfeed, they're the ones that raise kids and grow the food and make choices about what food should be eaten. Yet they own 1% of the land in Africa and they access 10% of agricultural services. The natural thing, if you want to organize change in Africa, you have to concentrate on women. So I think that's a very important thing. The second is young people. You know, increasingly young people, even in South Africa, are taking to the streets. They're organizing themselves like we organize ourselves. But these are new social movements. Demand for quality education is a principle in our constitution. There are kids now organizing. They took government to court the other day. And the demand was, why should their kids be in mud schools? And eventually, the court was going to rule in their favor. The government conceded, signed an agreement, gave them dates, and the communities that were then informed about when these schools will be built, everything. There has to be a legal court agreement. And then they organized and they had 100 students outside the parliament with their desks and everything, and they built this replica of mud schools. And said, now, that's what they're doing. They're doing, they organize. Their rights in the constitution, they're organizing themselves, and they're fighting for these rights. So I think that's what you've got to do. Social entrepreneurship is fundamentally important. You know, the idea is that, are you going to wait for someone to come and give you a job, or are you going to go and create something? I mean, I had a wonderful idea the other day. I saw a son of a friend of mine. So they came back, two guys, came back from Harvard, top Ivy League university, MBAs, a couple of degrees under the belt. They came back home. So they said, well, we can go to work in Credit Suisse or Citigroup, or we can do something. So they decided they're going to the townships. So they decided to do this. They had meetings like this in the townships. And they said, we're going to take 100 people, we're going to put them through tests, and then we're going to choose 3 people. And then we're going to support them to build businesses that are viable. And it was amazing. They've started. And they've already got successful entrepreneurs that are delivering services in the poorest area on a proper business model that, with all their theory that came from Harvard University, they're making something work. The thing that university is supposed to teach you is innovation, thinking out of the box, using your expertise. Go and find the things that you can change people's lives. You know, you don't have to have some book written to you about what to do. Use common sense and use the skills that your education has given you. And if you have it in your heart that you want to make a difference, then you got the right chemistry. Got in your heart that you want to drive a Porsche, then you'll do it something else. Got to have something in your heart. Thank you very much.